this is Brian Mabry, and this is episode 6 of the Planning and Zoning News Podcast. I'm an urban planner in Elkhart, Indiana, and in this podcast I read news articles that are related to urban planning and zoning. And that was my friend Chris McFarlane bringing us in with the song On the Wing from his record The Unraveling. Today I'll cover planning for libertarians, I'll cover problems with the word issues, I'll be reading an article about failing at form-based codes, and also one about Cincinnati tossing out parking requirements. But first we have an article called To Connect or Not Connect, and that is in the Better Cities and Better Towns blog, which is bettercities.net. And this was posted by Dan Zack on September 23rd, 2013. Perhaps it is a natural territorial instinct to wall ourselves into a protected enclave. Much has been written about the late 20th century phenomenon of gated developments, but that isn't the only time we block access in our neighborhoods. The lollipop cul-de-sac street patterns of many American suburbs are also meant to block, and sometimes older neighborhoods are retrofitted to block auto access, pedestrian access, or both. As a planner, I see this a lot, but I recently saw it in action in my own neighborhood. I live in an older neighborhood that for the most part has a walkable street grid. Slicing diagonally through the neighborhood is a major piece of underground infrastructure. On the surface, some of this land is occupied by parks, some by parking lots, some is incorporated into adjacent private yards, with the caveat that no structures may be constructed over it, and some is vacant and unimproved. Part of it near me was a park, which was ripped out a while ago when the underground infrastructure was upgraded. Our Parks and Recreation Department held a couple of neighborhood meetings to work on a new design for the reconstruction of this park. This all went very well, and the new park is doing great, but something really stood out to me. The infrastructure corridor continues past the park through a very long block, providing the potential for a direct pedestrian connection to a major street with some great amenities, including one of the best pizza joints in town. Some of us asked for this stretch, which is presently fenced off, to be opened up. Many people in the area have actively fought this connection, though, and it will not be opened. Why we block? Why is this done? In a society that is so obsessed with connectedness of the digital variety, why are some of us shunning connection in our cities? I have encountered three primary reasons, all of which are rooted in fear. 1. Fear of traffic. People in single-family neighborhoods, despite often driving a lot, are not big fans of traffic. Specifically, they want their residential streets to be free of large volumes of fast-moving cars. Some fear the noise that comes with cars, and some fear for the safety of their children. It's very understandable. Fear of on-street parking jams. Some people worry that by providing connections into their streets, people from other areas will park on the streets and take up all the on-street spaces. This was one of the main fears in my neighborhood, as the proposed connection would have provided a direct link to a new apartment building which is currently under construction. Incidentally, this probably won't be a problem, as the new building will have a large and convenient garage for tenants and guests. Fear of crime. Many people fear that connections will allow unsavory characters to wander into the streets and wreak havoc. Sometimes this is due to simple bigotry, other times it's due to legitimate concerns based on recent criminal activity in the area. The problem with blocking. While I understand these fears, disconnectedness is not the answer. We must resist the urge to block paths and close off neighborhoods from each other. Blocking connections won't solve any problems and may create new ones, including dangerous dead ends. If you're worried about crime, it's hard to understand how creating dead ends helps anything. Interconnected street networks offer many ways in and out, meaning that there are escape routes in case of an emergency. Dead ends get their name for a reason. No eyes on the street. Lack of connectivity means longer walking routes. Longer walking routes means fewer people will walk. Fewer walkers means fewer witnesses, or eyes on the street, in the words of the great Jane Jacobs, which criminals love. By offering many connections, walking is more convenient, meaning safety is enhanced. Slower emergency response time. In an emergency, every second counts. Fewer connections means less direct routes to some locations. It also means that some locations will only have one access point. A stalled car or fallen tree can leave these areas inaccessible in a crisis. More traffic fatalities. A recent study by Wesley Marshall and Norman Garrick of the University of Connecticut found that the frequent intersections of a highly connected street pattern calm traffic and increase safety. Sparse street networks with few connections facilitate higher speeds and more deadly crashes. Jammed major streets. While no one wants a lot of through traffic zipping through neighborhood streets, disconnected street networks push nearly every trip, no matter how small, out to the major streets. This often jams them up needlessly. My children's former in-home daycare was only 0.7 miles from our house, and yet the disjointed street network of a townhouse development between our homes forced me out to a state highway which is hopelessly congested for this minor trip. More vehicle miles traveled. Each lost link in the system causes somebody to drive a little farther than they otherwise would have. In isolation, this isn't a big deal, but in the aggregate, it's a big environmental problem. Here's an example. Let's say that one block of one street is blocked off in a neighborhood. Let's say that it was a lightly traveled block with only 5 cars using it per hour over 18 hours of the day. I'll assume that each car has its trip lengthened by just 1,000 feet as they go around the new obstacle. No big deal, right? Well, with the average U.S. car getting 24.6 miles per gallon, and with the burning of a gallon of gasoline releasing 19.6 pounds of carbon dioxide into the air, the loss of this one link in the neighborhood would result in up to 5,000 pounds of extra carbon dioxide in the atmosphere per year. Is it worth it? Less walking. Long blocks and broken connections make walking impractical. A comfortable walk is considered by most to be about 5 minutes or about a quarter mile. The more links that you break in the neighborhood, the less it is reachable within 5 minutes. The graphic below demonstrates this with a hypothetical neighborhood. The red dashed circle represents the area within a quarter of a mile from the red dot at the center of the neighborhood. The blue area represents the lots that can actually reach the center within 5 minutes. As you can see, the more disjointed the street network, the less walkable the neighborhood becomes. How to address traffic, parking, and crime without blocking. We block because we're afraid of traffic, parking, jams, and crime. But blocking doesn't fix these problems and only creates additional problems, so what do we do? Traffic. Use traffic calming techniques. There are many proven traffic calming techniques that can slow neighborhood traffic down to safe speeds without creating a bunch of dead ends. Examples include small traffic circles squeezed into intersections which force drivers to slow down to go around the obstacle, corner bulb outs which tighten the turning radius, chicanes which strategically narrow the road, and many others. Use designs which slow but not those which block or divert. Parking. Park in your garage. As this brilliant blog post by Alan Durning points out, many people can be quite territorial of the on-street parking spaces in front of their houses, despite the fact that this is community property that can be used by anyone. Some people just don't like the look of a bunch of parked cars, which doesn't jive with their presuppositions of country-like suburban living. But for most folks, the on-street parking spaces are an invaluable part of their parking supply. This is because they do not use their garage for parking, but for storage of extra living space. If folks want a guaranteed private parking spot, then they need to provide it on their own property, period. If they want to use their property for other things, then they have to deal with the inconvenience of competing for public parking on the street. For areas with a limited off-street parking supply and big demand on the on-street parking supply, there are ways to manage it which can improve performance, which are mentioned toward the end of Mr. Durning's post. Crime. Put eyes on the street and work with the police. Crime is terrifying, and I understand the desire to keep it at bay, but the sad reality is that creating dead ends and making walking impossible will not improve crime. Encouraging walking is helpful, and designing new buildings to have windows and doors facing the street goes a long way too. This creates a lot of opportunities for the natural and casual surveillance of the street. One of the best resources on designing crime out of neighborhoods is Chapter 2 of The Death and Life of Great American Cities by Jane Jacobs. Beyond that, I would suggest block parties to help neighbors get to know one another, neighborhood watch programs to report suspicious activity, and working with local police to improve safety in the area. To connect or not to connect? Definitely connect. It won't affect traffic, parking, and crime as you may fear it will, and there are better solutions for these issues anyway. More importantly, you will improve walkability and shorten driving trips, making your neighborhood more convenient and less polluting. This article makes me think of a couple of things. One way to require connectivity in a zoning ordinance or unified development code or subdivision regulations would be a connectivity ratio requirement that requires a certain number of street lengths per intersection so that you create a more of a network of new streets in a new development. And another thing, way to bring more eyes onto the street is to have your homes and businesses closer to the street with parking in the rear so that people inside the buildings can more easily see what's going on outside. The next article is called Strong Towns for Libertarians, and it is on the Strong Towns blog, which is networkedblogs.com/OHKIH. So probably if you search for Strong Towns blog, then you would find it. And it was written by Andrew Burleson and posted Tuesday, August 20th, 2013. Today I'm continuing my look at the reaction we get when we bring the Strong Towns message to communities and other groups. As a refresher, when we present the Strong Towns message, we generally do it in three parts. One, the current way we are building our cities and towns is financially disastrous. Two, the objective of our cities should be productivity rather than growth. Three, to get healthy, our cities are going to have to stop business as usual and rethink just about everything. In the first post, I shared Arnold Kling's idea of the three political languages, progressive, conservative, and libertarian. In part two, I talked about how we share the Strong Towns message with conservatives. Continuing an order of reflexive resistance to the Strong Towns message, today I'd like to talk about how we reach libertarians. Libertarians tend to have mixed reactions to the Strong Towns message. On the one hand, true libertarians are naturally skeptical of big government and big business and not terribly shocked by the financial data we're sharing. It isn't hard for them to imagine that unwise government spending and the big businesses that capitalize on it have created an economic Ponzi scheme. The idea that towns should focus on local productivity tends to go over pretty easily as well. In my experience, where most libertarians balk is at the idea that an entirely different development pattern is called for. As Kling described it, libertarians see right and wrong principally in terms of freedom versus coercion. When we start talking about government policy change to support a different development pattern, it's easy for a libertarian to interpret that as a call for government-mandated lifestyle change. A common reaction might sound something like this. You know, it all sounds fine to say we just need a new way of building stuff, but you're not taking people's choices into consideration. This is a free country. People have to live the way they want to live, and we just can't force everyone to move into some little place in town. I find most libertarians see the development pattern primarily as a lifestyle choice, which therefore means it represents the outcome of freedom, which would mean a different development pattern is a form of coercion. Where I have found the biggest breakthrough is talking through the countless forms of coercion that have been used to bring about our current development pattern, much of which the public at large is not aware of. I like to use the hypothetical Main Street as the focus of this conversation, in part because it's an iconic bit of Americana, and in part because it's less personal than talking about someone's specific neighborhood. I start the conversation like this. In nearly every city and town in this country, Main Street is illegal. If I were a developer and I thought Main Street was great and I wanted to go a mile down the road and build an exact copy of the town's historic Main Street, I would not be allowed to. Why is Main Street illegal? Here are five reasons. Zoning. One of the defining characteristics of a typical Main Street is the presence of two- and three-story buildings with cafes, shops, galleries on the ground floor, and offices or apartments upstairs. Under conventional zoning ordinances, this mix of land use is not normally allowed. While some cities have begun to add a mixed-use category into their zoning code, these rarely allow new development to be flexible, adaptable, and change in use over time, as the buildings of the historic area were allowed to do. Subdivision requirements. The typical Main Street lot is 25 feet wide and 80 to 100 feet deep. Most cities have a minimum lot width of 50 feet and a minimum area of 5,000 square feet, meaning the smallest allowable lot is 50 feet by 100 feet. The Main Street building usually is built all the way to the edge of its lot, meaning the storefront sits directly beside the sidewalk, often with a canopy overhanging the sidewalk, and the building is touching side by side with its neighbors. Most subdivision regulations call for a 15-foot to 20-foot front setback and at least a 5-foot side setback on all new lots. These two provisions make it physically impossible to create new Main Street buildings. And those are actually more zoning related than subdivision requirement, but that's just my note. Conventional street hierarchy. Another common feature of a historic Main Street is on-street parking. Main Streets tend to be major roads leading to the center of the city. Under the conventional hierarchy, these roads would be considered arterials. However, arterial roads normally require a minimum of 2 lanes each direction with a center turn lane, a minimum speed limit of 40 to 45 miles per hour, and do not allow on-street parking or buildings near the street. These features are quite different from and incompatible with the Main Street retail environment. Further complicating matters, most Main Street areas are part of an area with many small streets and small blocks. These tight grid-like networks allow large volumes of traffic to flow in and out of the Main Street area without any one street having to carry too much load. However, this pattern does not match the conventional street hierarchy. In most cities, it would be illegal to build a new development with grid-like street pattern. Parking requirements. Most Main Street buildings occupy the entire lot. They don't have any parking lot on their land. Instead, they rely on on-street parking, shared parking lots that serve the entire Main Street area, and people who arrive by walking, biking, or public transit. Sharing parking enables great flexibility for these businesses. A single parking lot can easily serve a coffee shop in the morning, electronics store during the day, restaurant in the early evening, and bar at night. If each of these buildings had separate parking lots, they would be empty for large portions of the day. However, most cities require all new developments to come with a large parking lot on the same property as the building. In most situations, the parking area is required to be about 3 to 4 times larger than the building area, which forces individual buildings to be spread apart with parking lots in front of and in between the buildings. Therefore, the Main Street pattern, shops lining the sidewalk with shared parking located elsewhere, would be illegal. Detention and impervious cover requirements. As mentioned previously, most Main Street buildings occupy their entire lot. This means that when it rains, the water runs off from the building and into the storm sewer. Most cities now require all developments to include a certain amount of open ground for water to soak into to reduce runoff. They also require each building to provide ditches or ponds to collect rainwater and hold or detain it during a storm to limit the flow of rainwater into the storm sewer system. As with parking, these rules make it very difficult to share detention facilities in areas with many different property owners. Coupled with the requirement to provide large parking lots, which are the chief cause of excess water runoff, these requirements mean that every new building must be spread far apart from every other with land set aside for handling stormwater on each property. These requirements make a small-scale, compact retail street with shared infrastructure illegal. After running through this breakdown of the status quo, most libertarians are both surprised and upset that there are so many constrictive rules in place that they were not very aware of. More important, our call for municipal reform is not that cities need new, more nuanced, and more numerous rules to handle more situations. Rather, we suggest that most of the rules in place could simply be scrapped and we could, in fact, be better off. Once we've reached this point in the conversation, the libertarian segment of the population often become great contributors to the strong towns idea. This is the group of people who tend to be the biggest believers in the power of organic, bottom-up systems to achieve great outcomes. Consequently, they tend to have lots of great ideas about how to build strong towns. The third article comes from Plan Edison, which is planedison.com, and it's an opinion piece by Todd Littman called "I Have a Problem with Your Issues," with issues in quotes. And it was posted September 15th, 2013. Planners are professional problem solvers. We manage the process through which problems are defined and potential solutions evaluated. This process requires clear statements concerning what stakeholders want or oppose. I therefore have a real problem if people apply the term issue when referring to something undesirable. It is weak language which implies but fails to clearly state what the process is intended to accomplish. I appreciate how this trend began, Countless psychologists have assured their patients that being overweight or gay or dropping out of college are issues to be addressed rather than problems to be criticized. In that context, it is quite appropriate to use non-judgmental language. But planning is concerned with judging, discerning the best solutions to a particular set of problems. In that context, I find the word issue grating like fingernails on a chalkboard because it implies that there is no way to determine what is desirable or undesirable, so the planning process is futile. Our most important tool is clear language concerning what stakeholders want, how much they want it, and what they are willing to trade off to achieve a particular outcome. Here's the hierarchy. Identifying an issue simply says that something deserves attention but is ambiguous. For example, if somebody says affordable housing is an issue, it could mean they believe there is a shortage of lower-priced housing and want more, or it could mean they feel frightened by the presence of lower-priced housing in their neighborhood and want less. A goal statement identifies in a general way what is desired. We want more affordable housing is a goal statement. An objective is a specific way to achieve a goal. Our city should support multifamily housing development to increase the supply of lower-priced housing is a clearly defined objective. Housing is unaffordable for many lower-income households is a good problem statement. An even clearer approach establishes measurable performance targets. For example, you could establish a target that all households be able to find suitable housing that costs less than 32% of their total budget, or even better, that costs less than 45% of their household budget for housing and transportation combined, since housing is not really affordable if it is located in an accessible area with high transportation costs. Measuring the number of households in a community that spend these thresholds help measure the problem and provide a reference for tracking progress toward that goal. The strongest approach defines specific performance targets and consequences for meeting or failing to meet them. For example, a housing plan could include a requirement that developers sell at least 10% of units at a price that will cost less than 32% of the budget of households in the lowest income quintile, or contribute $10,000 to an affordable housing fund. This defines not only what we want, but how much we want it and what we are willing to do to ensure it is achieved. While I'm at it, let me mention some other opportunities to clear planning language. The word choice can be confusing because it is both a noun, as in options, and a verb, as in a decision. For example, the term travel choice can refer to the options available to travelers on the decisions they make. For that reason, I suggest using travel options and travel decision instead of travel choice. For example, it is clearer to say that improved walking and cycling conditions help increase travel options rather than travel choices. Similarly, I recommend using the term difficult rather than hard, since the former has one clear meaning while the latter has several. For example, the statement, "The sidewalk project was hard," could mean that the process was difficult or the resulting facilities are solid. Another term that should be used carefully is conservative, as in, "These are conservative cost estimates." In this context, conservative is assumed to mean cautious, which seems good, but traffic engineers will often use the term to justify oversupplying roadway or parking capacity, reflecting an assumption that more is better. In that context, oversupplying roadway capacity tends to increase project costs and include additional vehicle travel, which actually increases resource consumption and so is the opposite of conservative. In that context, I recommend the term lower bound or upper bound estimate, which more clearly indicates the likely direction of error. These are examples of flutter words which have multiple possible meanings and so require more effort to understand. For example, if somebody refers to travel choices, you need to think about which meaning applies depending on context. There is less potential for confusion if travel options refers to the range of modes available and travel decisions refers to the modes that users actually choose. These are just a few examples of ways that planners can apply clearer language. What other examples can you offer? I agree. I think issues gets overused in the office, and I've started a little bit before I even saw this article, started to try to avoid using that term and to just call a problem or something that needs attention, you know, something that needs attention. The fourth article is Ways to Fail at Form-Based Codes 1. don't articulate a vision. And as the name implies, the one means it's the first of a series. I think there are four articles in this series. And this is from the placemakers.com website, the Place Shakers blog. And the article is written by Hazel Borries. It was posted on February 21st, 2013. Last week, we were talking about how the form of a neighborhood either provides gathering places that build social capital and local resilience, or else makes for a lonely, disconnected nowhere. Some towns and cities are using form-based codes to help reconnect people with each other and the places they call home. At the end of last week's discussion, I quickly mentioned 10 points that can create problems with form-based codes. My friend Bruce Donnelly commented that some of these points bear elaboration. So today I'm doing a back of the envelope on the biggest challenge to form-based codes, failing to establish a community vision that can then be codified, that is, made into law. Maybe you could boil down many of our dysfunctions, from local governments to individual choices, to not taking time to establish a vision, a sort of what I want to be when I grow up process that leaves behind the vagaries and platitudes that generate places that fall short of being unique. Great visions almost always center on what is special about a place. Smaller cities often focus on natural features like mountains, waterways, or plains, or extraordinary social amenities like strong arts and cultural communities, or foodie havens, or quaint main streets built for antiquing and local music. Bigger cities almost always offer up creative class amenities like Startup City Miami, or Strong Smart New York, or Toronto the Big, or maybe it's Dare to Live Outdoors San Diego, or the great pub sheds in Decatur or Asheville. Visions that can be codified, made into land use laws that say how neighborhoods will form, are much more nuanced than a slogan or a core competency, though. They're broken down into vision, policy, actions, and plans, along with public-private partners who are willing to do the hard work of bringing it all to a reality, the vision keepers, if you will. One of the most enjoyable form-based codes I've ever helped lead was thanks to a great city planner, Gianni Longo, who had done the hard work of helping craft a vision for Kona, Hawaii. When we came in to help with the form-based code, the well-articulated vision was strongly supported locally, and the codification was a delightful process. Often, policy planning, master planning, and land use law are more closely married, and that's when it's sometimes harder to ensure that there is a collective local vision, although I realize that many people have issues with this phrase. While a consensus plan may not pander to the most extreme special interest groups, it generally seeks to find common ground. Looking at a few vision documents that have generated great codes and plans, El Paso, Ransom, and Miami come quickly to mind. Quoting a bit from Ransom, "All of the goals of the community vision assume the principle of connectivity. A fine network of thoroughfares should knit together the community. The goal also will draw upon the principle of sustainability. Places must be ecologically, fiscally, and socially sustainable. 1. Local character builds regional economies. 2. Strong core communities make strong foundations. 3. There is a place for everything, and everything has its place. 4. Affordable living includes housing, transportation, energy, recreation, and shopping. 5. Green infrastructure supports sustainable communities. 6. Neighborhoods are the building blocks. 7. Private buildings and public infrastructure work together to shape public space and to build community character. 8. Working together creates bigger opportunities." Of course, each of these items have a whole host of idea development and supporting actions, but the point is that the city has spent the time to articulate what it believes, hash out the details to get to common ground, then wrote it all into law with a form-based code. And that's what'll get you around item one for the biggest Achilles heel possible for your form-based code, failing to articulate a generally accepted local vision. Now, once again, for a little inspiration from Steve Muzon, documenting Paris, perhaps the most extreme example of a vision getting implemented, even if it wasn't the collective local vision, but rather a much heavier-handed version of top-down planning. Nevertheless, it's one of the few cities where even the bridges are able to bring me to tears. Enjoy! And what follows are several great pictures of streetscapes in Paris, France. And our fifth and final article is from the Cincinnati Business Courier, and I would suggest Googling that. The URL is www.bizjournals.com/Cincinnati. And then I think if you go that far, then you would be able to find this. Of course, I'll have a link for this on my Tumblr feed, which, by the way, is zoningnews.tumblr.com. And I'm on Twitter at @zoningnews. So, city tosses out residential parking requirements. This was written by Randy Symes, and it was posted August 26, 2013. Cincinnati Mayor Mark Mallory has approved an amendment to the city's zoning code that eliminates parking requirements for many residential developments and substantially reduces them for others. The ordinance, signed on August 7th, tosses out the city's existing minimum parking requirements within the zoning code's downtown development overlay districts, which cover the Central Business District and Historic Over the Rhine. Under the new regulations, any residential development with 20 or fewer housing units would not have to provide any parking, while those with more than 20 units would have to provide 0.7 spaces per housing unit above 20. That means that a development with 32 housing units would need to provide 9 parking spaces. In April 2012, just weeks after Urban Cincy laid the groundwork for reforming the city's parking policies, Vice Mayor Roxanne Quayles and City Council members Yvette Simpson, Wendell Young, Cecil Thomas, Chris Seelbach, and Lori Quinlevin signed a motion urging the removal of all parking requirements in the Central Business District and Over the Rhine. While the newly approved ordinance does not quite go that far, its proponents believe it's a step in the right direction. The goal of the ordinance is to encourage development in the urban core by permitting developers to determine their own parking needs for downtown development, explained Simpson, who is vice chair of council's Livable Communities Committee. I firmly believe that the market will work to meet parking demands better than government minimum parking requirements. According to Victoria Transportation Policy Institute, individual parking spaces add anywhere from $10,000 to $25,000 to the cost of a development, and City Council believes that by eliminating those mandates, they will make the center city an even more attractive place for private investment. The discussion about parking mandates in the center city has been ongoing for years and has taken on more prominence as private real estate investment in Over the Rhine has surged. Urban Cincy specifically called into question the size of the Mercer Commons parking garage in mid-2012. The work of eliminating parking requirements, however, may not be finished. The approved ordinance also calls for the deregulation of minimum parking requirements in other neighborhoods through the establishment of urban parking overlay districts in areas to be determined by council. If City Council decides to move forward with establishing new urban parking overlay districts, there would be no parking requirements for any use other than residential developments greater than 20 dwelling units. This is slightly different from the modification to the Downtown Development Overlay District, since they still require some minimal parking requirements for office uses. One of the earliest beneficiaries of the new standards might be the renovation of 906 Main Street, which would not need to provide any parking spaces under the new standards. The $400,000 project will transform the largely vacant structure into 20 apartments above 6,705 square feet of street-level retail. The new ordinance took effect immediately. This ordinance will encourage private investment by reducing the amount of government regulation, Simpson continued. This also encourages a walkable, pedestrian-friendly urban core, which is more attractive to residents and visitors. And I was giving a talk the other day this week at a local college to some students and people interested in sustainability, and I was telling them about how it's becoming more and more popular for communities to not require a certain ratio of parking spaces per square foot or per employee or whatever the case may be, and that it's more common to leave that up to the market. Same goes for loading spaces as well. And I think they were a little surprised by that, but were open and relatively glad to hear that. And that concludes this sixth episode of the Planning and Zoning News Podcast. Again, you can see my website at zoningnews.tumblr.com, and you can find me on iTunes, search for Planning and Zoning News Podcast, and you can follow me on Twitter at @zoningnews. And we are going to wrap up this episode with a song by the Afghan Whigs. They are a band out of Cincinnati, and they've been around since, I would say, the mid-90s, and are still making music off and on, even now. And this song is called Debonair. Thanks a lot for listening, and I'll see you next time.
Don't forget, I'm not the man my actions would suggest.